Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the In the Crease Podcast. We are post-quarterfinal weekend. I am your host, Dan Abern, contributing writer at Inside Lacrosse, joined today by my esteemed colleague.
My name is Kyle Devitt. I'm the Gear and Lifestyle Editor. I went 0-for-4 in my picks this weekend. I'm really upset.
Kyle, three words. Next stop, Foxborough. IL is coming up north. We are shipping up to Boston for the Final Four. And I gotta say, I don't know if anybody saw half of those Final Four teams coming in Towson and Ohio State.
No, for sure not. For sure not. I'm a little concerned about the specific teams that made it. I don't know who's going to travel. I hope everyone travels really well. I hope they do not stay in Boston. Guys, for the millionth time, Providence is closer with traffic. I'm just saying. Maybe they're equidistant mile-wise. That's great. Someone threw that stat out at me this weekend. It might be true. But I'm telling you, traffic. I live up here. Y'all don't want no part of driving from Boston to Foxborough.
Pro tip from Isle North. Kyle, I was on site for each quarterfinal game. Me and Christian Sweezy did a fantastic road trip. We had a great time. And we went to see some great games. Maybe they weren't as great as we had hoped they would pan out to be. But, you know, not the best games, but certainly some interesting results. You know, I think we both came into this podcast saying, how does one even break down a blowout? Three of them ended up kind of being that way. But let's get straight into it. We're going to go in chronological order. Ohio State 16, Duke 11. You know, people asked me about this game, and I was like, how do you explain how Ohio State won? And it just kind of felt like coming into this game, we thought that Duke might be the more athletic team. But in the end of the day, they just could not match the physicality of Ohio State in this game. And then at one point, Jake Withers just gave them a clear advantage at the faceoff X. And they just ran away with it. They hit their shots. You know, the matchups were a little interesting. Fennell feasted early. And by that point, you know, it was just over. You know, Ohio State was in their game plan on how to win a game like this. And Duke just couldn't catch up.
Yeah, I think my biggest note on this game is that I'm just surprised Duke wasn't up for the moment. Because this is a Duke team that is built on being in the moment and being ready. Duke was a lot of people's dark horse to win the title this year, especially when they made the Final Four and people saw the path they had. They thought it looked a little easy. It's not easy. I thought they looked frazzled and frustrated on offense. You know, not to put it all on Fowler, but I think he had plenty of chances to make one big stop early. You know, one big stop early. You mentioned Fennell. I believe he was 3-for-3 on his shooting to start this game. I think OSU's finishing was too much. Fowler's defense was getting run by like missing children flyers. Like, it was bad. Like, you had to have somebody there sliding. And then when it was, you know, by the time let's dissect a blowout, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that happens in a blowout when you're down by a lot of goals and there's still time left is you switch into them and you can't get the ball in face-offs. You switch into a mode where your defense presses out because they have to. You have to try and get that ball back. You can't rely on Ohio State turning the ball over because, frankly, that's one of their best attributes. They don't collect turnovers like a lot of teams in this tournament have. They're very good at managing the ball, getting back, riding, and creating their own turnovers out of your mistakes. They don't make a ton of mistakes. And I think when you're in a position where you're playing a team like that, you have to take chances. And Duke did that. They just – it didn't work. You know, it opened up the middle of the field, and Ohio State really exploited it.
Absolutely. And I also thought matchups were a big part of this game. I know, like, people don't say, oh, don't look at the matchups. For me, individual matchups are so important, especially in a game like this, when the coaches admit it was part of what happened in this game. And Jasinski – playing at attack, starting at attack, which is a position I don't think he had started at for about a month or so. I thought that was a crucial move because that moved JT Giles-Harris onto him to match quickness and leaving Dunn on Fennell and then Kay Van Rapphorst on Trey Leclerc. You know, obviously, I think that's a solid game plan because you got to put your best defender on who's their most dangerous player. And for the past month or so, that's been Trey Leclerc. But, you know, Eric Fennell feasts with him being shadowed by Cade Van Rapphorst. And even after they move Cade Van Rapphorst onto him, he still kind of builds off that early momentum that he built. And then also Jasinski routinely took JT Giles-Harris to the rack and was beating him. He was getting a step on him throughout the game.
Yeah, well, one of the things that you're kind of illustrating here is, by the way, who told you matchups don't matter? Because that person is stupid. seriously, like, don't listen to that person ever again. The thing is that happens when you're in a pressing, you know, man-to-man defense is that you get taken out of your team defense. It's not a great team defense to play a press out, even if it's a limited adjacent press out or something, and everyone else is kind of back in the hole ready to slide. It doesn't work out. If you space correctly against a press zone and you have a press man and you have guys that are capable of stopping runs, even if the offense is bunched up, you're more concerned if you're the defender in that system with stopping your guy. It kind of puts you on an island. And you saw that in this game where Duke just flat out didn't slide. It wasn't that they weren't sliding. It's more that they're – long poles and short stick demonies were more concerned with their man because they were in a press man. But at that point, it's kind of too late. Like that's one of the only tactics that really works. That and a hard ride and winning faceoffs will get you possessions. You need possessions to score goals. Duke just didn't have enough of anything once this game was started and Ohio State popped out to that huge lead.
Yeah, and in the press conference, Coach Janowski reflected on one moment in particular. It was when Ohio State took a 2-1 lead in the final minute of the first quarter. Lucas Buckley just goes past Tommy Zanker, who he says is 6'3", 215, a senior, is a guy who should not be getting beat in that situation, and then they don't send help when he does. And he said that's when the light bulb went out for them, that we can run past these guys. And, you know, I thought on both ends Duke could not match the physicality, and I thought it was particularly pertinent with the matchups that Ohio State's defense went with on Duke's offenders. It was an interesting wrinkle putting Eric Evans, who's 6'4", on Justin Guderding, and putting their best cover man on Manown, and using Randall Moore as a slider with his athleticism. And of course, you know, we saw the whole game, Eric Evans just kind of like using his body, said, "You're not going to beat me, Guderding." And then when the D did break down, Tom Carey was excellent in the cage. 14 saves for him is just outstanding.
Oh, absolutely. And you saw a lot of those saves were stick, right? Like he got that ball and he got it right out. You know, that's one of the things that kind of separates good goaltenders from ascending to that greater plane. It's funny, using your pole as the slide, your best pole as the sliding pole is something you do when you have full confidence in your D unit. And obviously, like, it's not just that they thought Manown was the biggest threat. It's that they thought he was a key player in initiating and what they did. And it's funny, it's not that Manown's the guy that starts the dodge. He's the second guy for them. And he's the guy that actually helped, you know, Guderding get a lot of his points during the year because teams would have to respect his ability to dodge.
Yeah.
And using, you know, putting your best pull on him and then also pulling that guy inside to be the slider is going to mess up a lot of your plans, especially if you're trying to go through Guderding instead of Manown, which is what happened. And you have a note in here. Are you surprised with Ohio State? I want to further this conversation because we have to move on, but I got to be honest. Ohio State is a team I thought was poised to be good early in the season. And then they had this patch where they would like dip and not be able to score 10 goals. Like they beat UMass 9-8.
Yeah.
They lost back-to-back games to Penn State 9-4 and Notre Dame 12-7. And then they got back into their groove, and then they lost to Maryland in the Big Ten tournament. But even when they beat Loyola in the first round, it was 7-4. And to me, all of those were red flags. Big red flags. The problem is I didn't see the Buckeye painting on the red flag. This is a damn good team, man. And I definitely paid a little bit of my disrespects to them. I have this big plate in front of me. It's got a lot of crow on it. I'm going to be eating it throughout the podcast. I'm terrible at picking games. I went 0-4. I can't say it enough. Hopefully you didn't spend money on my picks. Please tell me you didn't. But, you know, this team, are they the favorite to win? Probably not.
But could we see them winning? Absolutely.
Could I see them winning? Yeah, man. This is a team that can win the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I'll cop to admitting that I sold Ohio State down the river at several points during the season. Like, I remember going to their game against Towson, which we'll come back to at the end of this podcast. It was one of the coldest days all year. Both teams played not great lacrosse. And the Buckeyes won 6-3, but even then I said, man, like, this team just can't score. Like, most of their goals came in transition. Like, they're very much a little bit of what they were last year in that they just wanted to get the ball and just grind out wins if they had to, low-scoring games. But you know what? After that back-to-back losses in the middle of the season, Notre Dame and then Penn State on the road, they got back in their groove and were a team that just got better as the season went on. They had to kind of figure out their personnel throughout the year. They flirted with Trey LeClaire at midfield, and then they kind of settled on him at attack, said, hey, like, this is a guy who can draw a number one defenseman every single game, opening up other great players on our team. And this is just one of those teams that on the eve of this tournament I thought was maybe the second best team in the country. I mean, you watched that game against Maryland in the Big Ten final. I said, man, like, both of these teams were there at the end. This is a team that is – these are teams that, you know, can match haymakers. And for them to almost steal the Big Ten title, I thought, man, this team is just as good as Maryland.
I agree. Let's move on to this next game we got here. Man, another one I was real wrong about. real wrong.
Oof.
We got
Denver.
Yeah, go ahead.
Denver 16, Notre Dame 4. You know, my first note of this, I'll read it word for word. One of the most dominant performances you may ever see in this sport. Trevor Baptiste, 21-22. The only faceoff he lost was the first faceoff of the game. He won 21 straight faceoffs. There really is not much else to say about this game than that. I mean, obviously, Denver looked good possessing the ball so much. I mean, the only thing that really stuck out to me, besides the way that Baptiste played, was that they got a great feeding day from Ethan Walker. He had 3 goals, 3 assists. He's a guy who is really kind of emerged as a set-foot finisher, a guy who, like Mikey Wynn, we've talked about all year, needs service from the other guys, but he dodged in this game. He fed in this game. That was impressive.
Yeah, 100%. Denver was impressive soup to nuts. The entire team was impressive. This was the best performance they had all year, in my opinion. Just straight up. In contrast, this is the worst performance I've seen Notre Dame have all year.
And I believe this is the most lopsided loss for them since, like, 1997.
Wow.
Yeah. Sweezy and all those guys did their research. It was – and, you know, Kevin Corrigan, post-game, had – you know, I said this could be the title of the game story. He said, I can't remember a game within the past decade where my Fighting Irish team did not have a chance to win in the fourth quarter. And that was just the most pertinent quote I could possibly think about to sum up this game. It's just like, he said it so succinctly. Like, the guys in the locker room have never lost like this. This is just an anomaly of a performance for them.
It's one hell of a humble brag.
Yeah.
Really. For real. It's like the greatest humble brag I've ever heard a coach espouse. You have a note on here. Notre Dame ran into the wrong team at the wrong time. I don't know if any team could have beat Denver, but I don't know if Notre Dame could have beat any team with a performance like that.
That's true. I mean, for me, when I wrote that note, it's just like they're one of the teams in the ACC that do not perform well on faceoffs. They go against the team with the clear-cut best faceoff guy in the country. And then even when they're facing a possession deficit like they are in this game, the guys that they need to step up are their stalwart scorers. And those two guys, you know, are recovering from injuries. And then you've got a guy on the defensive end in Kashansky who's out.
Yeah. This is such like a really negative thing to say. And Notre Dame fans, like, just turn the podcast off. You don't want to hear this, but maybe you should hear this. There's no adaptability with this squad. It's just they rely on their defense to bail them out. They rely on their relentlessness pursuing the ball and ground balls. They rely on the robotic nature with which they ride, and I mean that in a positive way, where they ride, the way they press, the way they throw checks, the way they play team defense, you know, the way they try to manufacture transition. That means nothing if you can't score in the six. And by the way, Notre Dame is probably one of the best teams at all those things that I just said in the country. But I tell you what they're not good at, and that's scoring in the 6-on-6. And that was so apparent in this game when you see a team like Denver, whose specialty, yes, they get fast break goals from the faceoff. Sure, that's great. But Denver's specialty is cutting you and cutting you and cutting you and cutting you. And all of a sudden, there's blood everywhere. And there's a goal in the back of the – there's a ball in the back of the net. Like, this is a team that will wear you down and run past you and look for the easiest shot possible and can it. That's what the team's built for. Denver is built for that. That's the genius of the Brown offense, of the Matt Brown offense. That's the genius of it, is that they want layups. They don't want to take 15-footers or 15-yard shots. That's not what they want. They want the easiest shot possible. They want to play for layups. And they didn't even have to do that in this game because Notre Dame couldn't get the ball. Everything they did was off of swing passes and hitting the open man because Notre Dame over-adjusted on their slides. And Denver adjusted better. They made the better adjustments. And they didn't just win this game. They dominated.
Yeah.
And if you're a Notre Dame fan, this is what you need. You need an offensive coordinator that has autonomy and will take chances. But I'll tell you right now, that guy's not getting hired in South Bend because that's Corrigan and Burns' team until it gets pried from their hands with crowbars and blowtorches. Notre Dame's identity will always be defense with those two guys in charge. And that's why they haven't won a title. And if you want to get mad at me for saying that, that's fine. I'm sure they're going to be pissed. But I believe that. This team needs offense to win. They need to score in the six to win. Yes, they need faceoffs as well. But if you're just blaming faceoffs, you're not looking at the bigger picture.
All right. Wow. That was very succinct, very thorough. Kyle, obviously a lot of team seasons are ending around this time. And if you're looking to cop some of their gear, if guys are selling them, you know where we can get it? Sideline Swap. Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear. Find deals up to 70% off on heads, shafts, helmets, and more. Or snag unique gear from colleges and the pros. Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely. List in seconds, and they'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit sidelineswap.com today to get started. That's sideline, SWAP.com. And Kyle, you know, with the release of the S that we've seen in the past couple of weeks or so, I think it might be a hot market for some swaggy R's hitting the Sideline Swap.
Absolutely. There are a number of super swaggy Cascade R's on the market. We got a Maryland one. I'm looking at an Oregon one from last week.
Ooh.
We have this really excellent Navy helmet that I haven't even seen them wear. I don't know how this dude got this, but it's a all Navy shell with a gold cage and a gold chin with the full Navy ram all across the right side of the helmet. It looks amazing. Definitely, if you're trying to upgrade your helmet, trying to get that helmet game up for summer ball, the best place to go is sidelineswap.com. Just search Cascade R, and you're going to have more options than you've ever seen in your life. And there are the higher-level colleges are a little pricey, but I don't know where else you're going to get them unless you go to the game and beg for the kid to throw you the helmet after the game. And that's not going to happen anyway because college kids get to keep their gear.
Yeah.
It's the only cool thing the NCAA does for them. So don't expect to get it handed to you, but definitely check it out on sidelineswap.com.
All right, Kyle, let's move to the Sunday slate of the quarterfinal matchups in Delaware. Hey, I'm in Delaware. Delaware Stadium, Newark, Delaware. What a place. Me and Sweezy rolled up early, got a feel for the town. We met Anish. Shout out, Anish. But the first game, Towson 10, Syracuse 7. But I just thought, a huge performance across the board from everybody on Towson. And there was a lot of scrutiny towards Alex Woodall's hamstring. Would he be healthy enough to give the Tigers a possession advantage, which is what they kind of need to win? And he did a great job. You know, it ended up 10-10, I believe, faceoffs. But he was crucial in the start, winning 5 of 7 in the first quarter. And then all of a sudden, you know, Sider, Lynch, all those guys for Towson are hitting their shots. Boom. It's 6-0. And that's exactly where Towson wants you to play at. Comeback. Because they got the defense, they got the rope unit to just strangle out a game like that. It was almost a defensive masterclass. You know, we talk about Towson. I was not really surprised that they won. You know, I went on the record and said that I thought Syracuse would win by one goal because hashtag assassins. But this is a team that knows what they need to do to win. And in every facet, they executed almost perfectly against Syracuse.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they couldn't get the ball. And the Towson D bullied them all day. And by bullied, I don't mean like, oh, they hit them really hard and took their lumps. I mean, they took their lunch money, they took their girl, and they stuffed them in a locker. And that's not something we saw happen to Cuse all season. So it's one of those games where everything went wrong for Syracuse. Everything went right for Towson early. And Cuse tried their comeback, man. But I got to say, save of the year from Hoy stops the Syracuse run. I thought the ball went in. He sprawls. Stops the ball. The ball pops out of his stick and somehow floats over the crossbar and lands on the other side of the cage. It was the most incredible thing. It was a point-blank shot. Maybe one of the most incredible saves I've seen all season. Just everybody came up huge for Towson. And for Syracuse, you cannot say that. You cannot say people came up huge for Syracuse in this game.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. Matt Hoy, I agree with you. There's a gif of that save on my Twitter profile if you want to go look it up. But I told you before the podcast that save basically won the game because Syracuse was making their run. They were making their fourth quarter magic, Dome Gods on the road. And then Matt Hoy just said, no, today is Towson's day. That was a statement save, and it really did have the effect of him taking the bobby pin and popping the balloon. All the air fell out of Syracuse in that save. But you're right. Towson's rope unit, they shut down Saucedo, Mariano. Didn't even feel like Trimboli played. Like, you know, Mariano and Saucedo combined for 2 points. It's like you need those guys to score. We've been saying it all year. Nate, I'll cop to Nate Solomon stepping up. He had 4 goals. Absolutely. He was awesome. But, you know, Jordan Evans, Steven Rafis were surprisingly ineffective.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Saucedo and Mariano worked really hard with the ball and off the ball to try and generate something. You know, obviously Solomon was the beneficiary of that a little bit. But I thought that Cuse only looked good scoring when it was a broken situation or early in the possession. And they didn't take advantage enough early in the possession. They got good shots, actually, and they would have been really smart to just attack right off the start, but it didn't happen for them. Watching the game, I was kind of screaming at my TV, like, go, 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 because when Towson gets settled, that's when they're at their best. You know, attack them when they're not settled. Attack them with shorthanded personnel. I mean, you saw Syracuse score shorthanded in the game. Take advantage of that. Do that. And it didn't happen for them. And, you know, again, it's sad to see a great team, you know, season kind of come to an end, but I thought they did a great job getting to this point. And I won't forget this team for a while. I really enjoyed watching them play. And I'm actually really excited to seeing guys like Furman, Saucedo, and Mariano play this summer in the MLL. And I think all three can start if the right teams draft them.
Yeah, our hashtag House of Assassins fell. But, you know, it was undoubtedly a really great season for Syracuse. I mean, I feel like the fans, you know, probably going to come down hard on them for this loss. You know, losing to Towson? Who's Towson? Like, let's say you guys had a great year. You know, the 11-1 goal games, you won 9 of them. You know, this team, you know, Furman, I believe Scott Furman said it after the game, this team didn't have quit in their vocabulary all year. And I think you got to praise this team for achieving what they did, because I feel like a lot of people said, you know, this team overachieved. I was like, maybe, you know, but this was a team that fought hard all year. And, you know,
Cuse fans just spoiled.
Yeah, I mean,
you're spoiled.
There is the tinge of this being the senior class First one, I believe, since 1979 to not make the Final Four. You know, that definitely stinks. But, you know, great team nonetheless. I thought they had a great season. It just did not end the way that people wanted it to. But thou shalt be punished if thou slepteth on Towson. I know these guys lost to Fairfield. They're by and far the best team in their conference. At the end of the day, you can say what you want about Hofstra, but they played two of the other three teams in the Final Four this year.
Mm-hmm.
Do not be surprised that this team made it this far. A good team that knows what they need to do to win. Their identity is clear. If you want to beat them, you got to hurt them in one of those areas.
Yeah. I don't know if they're worthy of scripture introduction, but okay. Like, they're good. Towson is good.
Yeah.
Hashtag we are good. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they match up in the next round. I think that's kind of your territory. You're going to take this one away.
Yeah, but I just want to give a shout-out to Towson, man. I'm from Towson. I grew up there. My mom went to Towson.
Oh, now you're from Towson.
I went to Towson's camp when I was a kid, when Tony Seaman was head coach. And my coach at this camp was Sean Adlin. So I'm happy for him, you know. Like, he would come out during the camp in his USA, you know, uniform, helmet, stick. He's like, who wants to play against me? And I went to the back of the pack.
Yeah. Did he have a neck back then?
I can't remember.
No, he didn't. Trick question. He's never had a neck.
All right, Kyle. Final game of the weekend. What many people thought would be the best game of the weekend did not pan out that way. Maryland 18, Albany 9. I got to say, this is legitimately the only result I'm surprised about. I mean, in the back of my mind, I thought maybe a week's prep, we'll see Maryland dominate in this game. But, man, I did not see a victory of this totality for Maryland at all. Like, I thought it would be, you know, if Maryland was – Maryland had the most potential to win by multiple goals. You know, if Albany was going to win, it might be one or two goals. But I thought Maryland could stretch it. But, man, doubling up the Danes, wow.
Boo.
What?
Nothing. That's all I have to say about this game.
Player of the game for me is easily John Guarino. You know, I said, I believe, on our podcast last week and in our Friday Epic Game Day live show that I envisioned no scenario where Ireland did not dominate at the faceoff X. So for Guarino to come in and go 12 for 14, fuel that early start for Maryland, that's the performance of the game for me. And then Rambo. Rambo might inadvertently win the Tui because he wants to win the Natty, man. Back-to-back 8-point days for him after registering just 7 points like a million times in his career. And, of course, Kelly, he's been hot. 5 goals for him. Rotans has really stepped up late in this postseason. They've just been awesome for about a month or so. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, obviously, I went to Maryland. Like, I can't say that I'm not biased towards them. But I felt for the Danes. I mean, we love the Danes all season, you know. Like, this is a team that's fun-loving. We love their haircuts. And we love the style of play that they play. You know, it's a fun team. You got to love Coach Mara and what he does with the program, letting those guys breathe and letting their personalities breathe and their, you know, lacrosse personalities breathe on the field as well. So it kind of felt like, you know, you didn't want it to end the way it did for the Danes. It just kind of felt unceremonious.
Yeah, I don't know, man. So you're kind of connected to the Maryland faithful, right? Do you have your hopes up? Or have they, like, cried wolf enough getting to this point and getting the championship game and losing? Like, are we going to have another year of Maryland jokes? Or is this going to be the shaking off of the curse? Because we've seen a lot of curses get lifted the past couple years. Cubbies, Cavs, all these teams winning championships. I mean, how do you feeling that? You feeling the juju of the year powering you here to a championship? If so, can I feed it some more so when they lose, I feed upon your sadness, or no?
I feel like you're going to be in the press box at Foxborough when, like, Trey LeClair scores the game-winning goal in overtime to beat Maryland. Just, like, ready with a bucket underneath my seat for the tears. The salty tears, and you're going to drink them.
Yeah. I'll probably just be there with a big smile laughing because, man, nothing would be sweeter as someone that works in lacrosse and is from the North as we say, we the North. Nothing would be sweeter than Maryland getting to the championship game and losing in the place of the most prestigious of champions, the New England Patriots. I would really enjoy it. I can see your face twisting into such pain. It brings me such joy. I really enjoy it. I think it's going to be great. All kidding aside, that's just a joke. I don't have any skin in the game.
All right.
Dan does. Dan wants Maryland to win.
Here's the deal. I would be lying if I did not say that my confidence in the team grew after this result. I look at the matchup with Denver. I think having a full week's preparation will benefit them. I like their chances, you know, to beat the other team. You know, whoever makes it, Towson, I think they match up well against because they're also a very well-balanced team. And then Ohio State, it's a team they're familiar with. They've already played them twice, proved that they could beat them in the Big Ten final. You know, I like Maryland's chances, but, you know, Denver is a tough opponent. Baptiste will be crucial. How they handle that. But, you know, me and Sweezy said it the whole weekend for Maryland. It's like we've been saying, you know, all these years that they've gotten to the Final Four and gotten to the national championship game. Maryland should win this year. That doesn't mean they will.
I tell you what, if Maryland loses again, I'm going to start making T-shirts. just straight up. I'm going to start making T-shirts, like, end the curse. Trust me, we had a whole industry of that before the Red Sox won.
Yeah.
Okay? It was an entire industry. You could go outside Fenway and buy any kind of T-shirt. It was like, reverse the curse.
All right.
That's great. Trademark me right there for Maryland.
All right. The looming Denver-Maryland matchup is a great segue into our first segment, Towaratan Watch. And in my opinion, the race is now wide open between three guys, Fields, Rambo, and Baptiste. And I really do feel that Rambo and Baptiste boosted their resumes this weekend, and they could very well be playing for the Towaratan on Saturday.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I don't know, man. Didn't the Danes go out around this time to Notre Dame when Lyle and Miles still won?
Yeah.
Is the Fields highlight goal not enough? Come on, man.
I don't know.
Let him eat.
The thing is that Rambo is consistently putting his team in a position to win in the postseason with his performance. I mean, 16 points in this postseason so far. And then, of course, Trevor Baptiste, you know, if there is an MVP award, he's winning it. But I think what's interesting is that the conversation revolves around being a lacrosse player and that, you know, Baptiste's technical skill at winning faceoffs somehow disqualifies him from being a lacrosse player because he's not a scorer or something like that. And it's just like, I don't really buy into that because I feel like, for me, faceoffs is the most skill-oriented facet of the game.
Well, it is now.
Yeah.
It never was that way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a relatively new development in the last 10 years is the specialization of the face-off position. I mean, that wasn't – I took face-offs in college. I was an attackman. Like, it doesn't – it's not something that even people thought was super important. It's like, oh, you have a good one. He's winning 60%. You know, you didn't have dominance – like you've seen in the last couple of years. I mean, Baptiste is a disciple of Greg Renlian, who might be the greatest faceoff guy of all time.
Yeah.
You know, and you're seeing what they can do. I mean, he's the only faceoff guy that's ever won MVP of a pro league that I'm aware of, you know, mm-hmm. indoor or outdoor. So I feel like the importance of the faceoff position is a newer development, and I think it kind of depends on who's voting for the Towaratan.
Yeah.
Are they in that older crowd? Because if they are, Baptiste can't win. Because of the reasons you just cited. If it's people that are knowledgeable and younger and respect the face-off position as they should, then I think he should win. You know, the thing about Rambo, too, is I mean, I had this discussion with Inside the Grass publisher Terry Foyt. If Rambo's not on Maryland, what kind of numbers is he putting up?
That's the thing.
Let me ask you what's your answer for that, because I legitimately don't know. You watch him way more than I do. So do you think he has much better numbers or a little worse? What are your thoughts?
I think, you know, if he's a guy like if he goes to play on Albany, like they would use him. he would have the same numbers as Fields, I would think. You know, like, he is a guy who's tremendously skilled, and when you watch him, like, every game, you just say, man, this is definitely one of the best players in college lacrosse, just because of the way he consistently scores. It's like there's nothing, nothing you can do.
This isn't the award for one of the best.
I know.
It's the award for the best. And for me, you can be the best player on a team that's not as good. I feel like Rambo benefits a lot from his team. Period. End of story. I feel like he does. It doesn't mean he's not good. It doesn't mean I don't think he's great even. I just think Fields did so much more for – without Fields, Albany goes like 500.
Yeah. I'll cop
without
that.
Rambo, without Rambo, Maryland still might be where they are.
It's true.
Or at least in the tournament. Danes don't make the tournament without Fields.
Here's a count. Here's so to a counter me, to
that's
that.
No, that's the tiebreaker. That's it. That's my opinion. I'm happy to hear your disagreement, but that's my tiebreaker, and that's why I think Fields should win.
Well, I'll say this: I don't think Fields' statistical output happens without TD Ireland this year. We look at what Maryland has done this year. So at the faceoff X, they play the number one strength of schedule. Rambo still puts up the points that he does. I think there's a certain chip that you got to get to him for that. I'll say that.
Okay. Does Rambo get the same amount of attention that Fields does? Because I don't think he does.
No.
And that makes the point total more important to me.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm not saying you can plug in a replacement level player for Rambo and Maryland is just as good. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, like, there are other weapons and other ways that you want to stop Maryland other than stopping Rambo. And I think that teams did that this year and had success against Maryland, not for the whole game, but for pockets that I don't think anyone had real success against Fields, except for maybe like Syracuse in like the first game of the season when they held him without a goal and he still had four assists and they had Scotty Furman on him. I mean, that's one of those things where, like, you're comparing – it's not apples to oranges. It's apples to apples. They're just different kinds of apples. You know, and one's bigger and tastes better, and I think it's Fields.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one thing I want to finish this segment with is that in the back of my mind, I feel like this could be a year where we have another co-winner scenario. I mean, we get to – I mean, like – it could very well pan out. Like, hey, Matt Rambo and Trevor Baptiste win the Tourton as co-winners. Or Matt Rambo and Connor Fields win the Tourton as co-winners. I feel like any one of those three guys could win. And I think, like, this is a year where we can honestly say, like, hey, you know, Matt Rambo or Connor Fields is the best player on the field, you know, in the play of lacrosse. But in terms of most valuable player, it's easily Trevor Baptiste because the way that he fuels that team. Like, face it, you know, we said this last week. Without Baptiste, Denver might not be in this tournament.
Right. I don't think it would be at all.
Yeah. So.
Because when the one time Baptiste has been neutralized, they lost to Marquette.
Mm-hmm. All right, so, Kyle. Let's move on. Let's take a little bit of a breather from lacrosse. Weird watch of the week. Every week, man. We love this segment. Do you have one this week?
I do. It's unfortunately, lacrosse related, and because Lax's Bay apparently. I gotta say, man, I'm easing back into MLL. It's been a rough couple weeks trying to get back into it. I'm really on board with everybody that's like, why are they playing right now at this point? Because the workload has increased for at least for me personally, going and doing a lot more NCAA stuff. Whereas in the past I've been, you know, MLL focused, and I haven't been able to do that this year. So for me, it's hard to find time to watch games, but Saturday night blocked out a big chunk, watched a lot of MLL, man. I watched a lot of it. And I got to say, the best 10 minutes of lacrosse this weekend, you're not going to believe this, was the last 10 minutes of the Launch versus the Rattlers. It was flames. You all missed it. You are sleeping on some great lacrosse if you're not watching MLL. This game was not the free Twitter game. This was only available on LSN. But I will tell you, the game was poor for the first three quarters and most of the fourth. But the last 10 minutes, Steven Brooks runs out of the box, takes a two-pointer that goes in on maybe, you know, the best goalie in the world, John Galloway. It was an unbelievable shot. It ties the game. Rattlers take the next face-off, win it, score, go up by one. Steven Brooks gets the ball again on the next possession after a very controversial push. Scores again with a snipe on Galloway from like 15, 14 yards out. Tie game. We're going to OT. Face-off kerfuffle. Rattlers can't do anything. Rattlers look terrible in this game, by the way. goes to OT. The launch get the ball after Drew Simoneau fails to pick it up after it's right by his feet. He freaks out. He slams his stick on the ground. Florida goes on possession. And let me tell you, do you want to guess who won this game for the launch? I know you're not like a huge MLL head, but like, I'm going to give you a hint here. He's an old head. He's our guy. He's our dude. You've met him. You know him. He's a wonderful man. Do you want to guess?
I don't know. Paul Gate? Gary?
Seriously, dude?
I'm just messing with you.
You are the worst. Chaz Woodson.
Aw.
Chaz Woodson.
I've never met Chaz.
Yes, you have. He was at Community Academy last year.
That doesn't mean I met him.
Well, you should have, because he's basically the Dos Equis guy for lacrosse. Seriously, he's amazing. Cans the shot after, you know, missing and actually tossing a defender's stick earlier in the game and not getting a penalty. Cans the game winner. They're interviewing him after. He's like slumped over the boards. He's like, I gotta go like home. I gotta get in the tub. Like, it was awesome. I love seeing that. I love that personal touch that the MLL brings that you're never gonna get from NCAA because all those players are protected by their coaches. You know, I know it sounds like a commercial for MLL, but hey man, NCAA is ending next week. You gotta do something.
Exactly.
You gotta go somewhere for your fix, and I feel like you gotta go to the MLL, man. You gotta go to the MLL.
Yeah, I mean, that leads me perfectly into my weird watch of the week. I mean, we're 1 week away from the season being over. Like, Memorial Day is 7 days from now, and, you know, what do I do to fill the time? Because I feel like most of the spring I've been watching lacrosse or watching replays. So, of course, there's Netflix. It seems like you've been the guy who's always been on the Netflix recommendation train, but I want to give a Netflix recommendation. I watched 2.5 episodes of one of their new series that premiered on Friday called The Keepers. And it's a true crime story about the murder of a nun in Baltimore. So there's a personal kind of commitment to it as well. And I just got to say, all you need is 2 episodes. I'm hooked. It's unbelievable. So good. You will watch the 2nd episode and you will be hooked. I guarantee it. And
right.
I'll just say this, like, yeah, I'm telling you personally, Kyle, like, I want to have like text conversations about this show with you. But the creepy thing is that I'm not going to give too much details away to the plot or anything like that. But there is a bad guy in this show. And basically I'm watching and I found out that the bad guy apparently worked at a place on my street in Baltimore where I live. Creepy.
Are you scared?
Well, and the crazy thing was is that I went to get a snack last night, local 7-Eleven, and I walked past this place. I'm not going to lie, I was a little creeped out.
I mean, you know, I love my murder shows.
You will love this show. It is a fantastic true crime. And really, the first 2 episodes are only the beginning.
Devitt Household has Discovery ID on a loop.
All right.
So I'm in. I feel good about it.
All right, Kyle, this is going to be a one-and-done segment this week because we'll just be talking about – we haven't even discussed what we're going to do for In the Crease next week because the championship game is Monday. But for whom the bell tolls? It's really just post-mortem, but D-Fly and Dixie kind of did that last year, so we wanted to give it a Metallica kind of spin since D-Fly is so not very high on Metallica. But basically, this segment is upon a team's death, we're going to give them a eulogy. An outlook for next season. A eulogy on this season and an outlook for the next one.
Yeah, I thought this was a Chris Cornell segment. I got super sad.
Mm.
Screw you, Dan.
I'm sorry.
It's upsetting.
All right, first, we kind of talked about it. Syracuse, you know, they had their nine lives, and maybe they used them all up, but it was a great season. They have a decent core of up-and-coming players coming back. You know, they're going to get back Bomberi, Solomon, Trimboli, I believe. And, you know, Saucedo and Mariano are not on this team next year. Evans is not on this team next year. It's going to be a bit of a new look. They're going to have to do a little bit of soul-searching in the offseason. A lot of guys who maybe didn't see the field last year are going to have to step up and take the field next year for the Orange.
Yeah, I don't think they're super excited for next year. I think these seniors did a lot of heavy lifting, and they're the reason that this team got as far as they did. And I don't know if anyone that's left there has the kind of leadership capabilities that I've seen as juniors or sophomores to elevate the team to the level they're at this year. But then again, I said that last year. So I feel like Syracuse finds guys, finds ways, you know. They're like life in Jurassic Park. They just find a way.
All right, Kyle. Duke. I thought a great year for them with a very underrated senior class. You know, not a lot of stars on that senior class, but guys in great positions to lead the team. They accomplished so much with a young team as well. Like, you look at the midfield, it was almost exclusively freshmen. And I think they'll be a power in the ACC in the next couple of years. And I think Justin Gooderding will be at the Tourton ceremony next year.
I mean, you would know what the level of recruits they're getting is at. Like, where are we at with them? Where are they ranked?
Well, they had the number one recruiting class last year. All those guys pretty much played this year. And then, of course, it's Duke. They're always getting great guys to come to their program. So I feel like with the way the amount of experience that this team gained this year, this is a team that could, you know, kind of getting back to that, you know, Duke is a Final Four mainstay again, you know?
I think we'll see. I think it remains to be seen with Duke. I'm still sour on that last performance. It left a bad taste in my mouth. I'm sure it left a bad taste in theirs. And they will hopefully come back a little reinvigorated. I think Manown's progression is key for them. I think he's going to be the guy kind of going forward, and obviously Gooderding is going to be there for a senior season, and I think he's going to ball out, but I think he needs Manown to be more of an initiator, become, you know, step into that leadership role similar to, and I'm not comparing him to Jordan Wolf because I know you did that. I got really mad when you did that, but compared to what Jordan Wolf did kind of in his sophomore year, I think that's something that he's one of those guys that needs to make the jump for Duke to be legit going forward in the ACC.
Okay. Notre Dame, I got to say, I think this is the least optimistic outlook of all the quarterfinal losers. They lose Sergio Perkovic. They lose Garrett Eppel. They lose Healy. They lose Shane Doss. You know, there's very few young players who can say gained experience this year. I mean, Brendan Gleeson and Ryder Garnsey, you know, pretty much started as sophomores. I think that is a positive, but they lose so many other seniors in important places. It's going to be a completely new-look defense next year for them. And you got to wonder, you know, the most lopsided loss since like 97. Is this the kind of loss that could set them down a bad path, leave a bad taste in their mouth for the next couple of years?
So Notre Dame has this rep against teams that like play against them. Teams hate Notre Dame. You know that, right?
Yes.
Like teams that play against Notre Dame, like if you talk to players after they graduate and you're like, oh, which team did you hate the most? Almost all of them, if they played Notre Dame, say Notre Dame. And that's because Notre Dame plays tough and they beat on you and their defense is hard to score on and they're annoying to play against. I'm not worried about this defense one iota. Am I worried about the offense? Yeah. Yeah, I am. They need to step up their recruiting game and get better offensive players and stop making everybody into a jack of all trades. Okay? Stop doing that and let play to players' strengths on offense. You do it on defense. I feel like you just need to do it on offense. And I know this sounds like the Kyle hating on Notre Dame podcast, but it's not. I think if you're a Notre Dame fan, you're nodding your head being like, yeah, we need to get better offensive players. We need to play better offense.
Yeah.
You know, pick and pick away, like pick, you know, like run cutters offense, like do something to get better looks for all of your players. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Gleason and Garnsey, I mean, Collins as well. These are guys that need to lead the team next year. And maybe you get a whole new attack and those guys all play midfield. I don't know. Maybe that's the solution. Maybe you run more guys out of the box, play more. You know, I thought they should have picked more for Perkovic all year. That's just my opinion. To play to his skill set, I think they need to be more adaptive on offense and not just rely on their defense to win them games, even though their defense, despite this last weekend's result, is stellar and is always in, you know, a top five defense in the NCAA. So I think you're right. I think they also need help with the faceoff X, which I'm sure they're addressing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Kyle. Finally, Albany, our Danes. I forgot to say earlier in the podcast, I saw my man, Barcelo Jordi, at the quarterfinals in Delaware. You know, not a far ride for him from Philadelphia. But he went there to see his ugly bastards, and it was not a great day for his Danes. But nonetheless, shout out Jordi. He's the man. Always a great hang. Sadly, with the Danes not going to Foxborough, Jordi will not be going either. But, you know, looking forward, I think the Danes could be an early favorite for the Final Four next year. I mean, you get back Ireland, you get back Connor Fields, and they've got a very special player in Tohoka Nanticoke coming to this team next year. You know, Quinn Kesnick said that he has the body of Matt Rambo with the hands of Lyle Thompson. Yeah, it's a somewhat accurate, you know, description. I always kind of compared him to a Cody Jamison type with maybe a little bit more flair. But he's a special guy. He wows you with his stick skills. He has a nose for scoring goals and finding open players. He will be a special player, and I do think that next year will be a special offensive year for Albany. And, of course, the only way is up if Scott Maher is coaching in the Capital Region.
The question is not any of that stuff you just mentioned. The question is, will Scott Maher be there next year with all of these very tantalizing coaching openings? I don't know. I mean, you know, pay the man his money, you know, give him his money. That's a Rounders reference for all of you people. It's not an actually like really bad accent, although it is a bad accent. But in the movie, it's bad, too. You got to pay the guy. You got to reward him richly for all that he's done with this team. All of his great work in the recruiting. You know, I love watching Albany play. They're one of my favorite teams to watch play. And next year, I Final Four prediction, I don't know. I'm not really good at predictions these days. You know what I mean? So I'm not really jumping on that boat. But yeah, man.
I have a good team.
I think their future looks the best out of all these teams, yes.
Okay. Very interesting.
I do.
All right, Kyle, let's wrap this up with a Final Four preview. We're coming up to Boston. We're coming up to IL North. First,
it's not Boston.
Foxborough.
Everyone needs to stop. Stop saying it's Boston.
Well, we're flying to Boston. So.
You ain't Boston.
Boston.
You ain't Boston.
All right, Kyle, first game already scheduled out, Ohio State Towson. I'll say this, like I mentioned it earlier, but this was arguably the worst game I saw in person all year, way back on March 15, 18 degrees, miserable windy day, and just bad lacrosse because of that. I would actually throw that out simply because it's going to be played in likely beautiful weather up in Boston. So this is going to be a different game. The one takeaway I would say from that game is that Withers proved that he could dominate Woodall in this matchup already, and I think that could definitely factor in to what happens in this first game. And another nugget. Ohio State has beaten all three teams that are in the Final Four along with them.
So you're picking Ohio State?
I would give them an edge, but, you know, that Ohio State loss for Towson kind of led to them addressing personnel issues. It will not be the same game, hopefully. But I wouldn't be surprised if Towson made the championship, but I think these are both two teams that know what they need to do to win. But I would give a slight edge to Ohio State simply because of Withers. He dominated in that game back in March.
Over, under for goals in this game.
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah.
How about 16 or 17?
Oh, man. All right. I was going to say 20, but, man, you went real dark. All right. That's fine. Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of this is going to be a game with a lot of rides, a lot of clears, and a lot of defensive schemes. And if you love defense and you're a nerd, This is your game. You know who I'm talking about. Hi, Patrick. You're going to love this. I can't wait to break down this game, probably with him. I believe he's coming with us to Foxborough. But defensively, that's where you're going to watch all the action happen, man. Obviously, scoring goals matters, but this is a game of adjustments. And the team that makes the best adjustment is going to win because they actually are very similar teams.
Yeah.
So and both have stellar goalies. Both have great defenses.
Good face-off both, guys.
Both can manufacture. Yeah, both have great face-off guys. Both can manufacture transition. And, you know, when they're on offensively, they're on. They're fun to watch. Mm-hmm. When they're off, they're not fun to watch, and it's terrible. So, and that's both teams. So I think that, you know, whichever team shows out early in this game, I think is going to win. And I don't think this is a comeback situation. I think we're working for the first quarter here. First 15 minutes going to determine a winner. I'm not picking anything. Screw you guys.
All right, Kyle, the second game of the Final Four, Maryland-Denver. I kind of felt all year that these two were due for a collision course sometime in the playoffs. Comes in the Final Four. I feel like last year we were robbed of that when Towson beat Denver in the first round. Of course, you know, that led to North Carolina kind of opening the door for them. Because if they ran to Denver, I don't know if that they would have won. But Maryland-Denver, 2015 title game rematch. You know, I think, like I said earlier, I think the Terps will once again benefit from having a full week of practice as opposed to the one-day turnaround that they did with Denver back in 2015. I think if the Terps can get into 35 to 40% on faceoffs, which is a tall task with the way Baptiste is playing, I think that they have a team that is front to back better than the Pios.
Well, I'll say this about Denver. Their polls are gigantic.
Yes.
And I think that Maryland will struggle against – traditionally has struggled against polls that are big and have great positioning and play good, solid defense on them. So I think that's something to watch. That's the biggest – not even matchup-wise. Like all across the board, Denver's polls are just huge. And I think that Rambo is not great against really big polls. I think he's better against guys that he can, you know, body up and roll on and kind of butt dodge into and get into better positions. That being said, I still think he's going to have a great game because, you know, he's Matt Rambo. I don't want people to think I hate on Matt Rambo. I think he's a really good player. I just like Fields for the two-y, as you said. But yeah, it's the face-off advantage is huge. I don't know if it's going to decide this game though, because Maryland's so good at getting the ball on the carpet and getting it up into their six. I think the team that takes and executes the best chances on offense is going to win, which sounds like, hey, the team that scores more goals will win. But I feel like if Denver is the team that attacks early and scores early against Maryland, that's how you beat Maryland, because they don't like playing defense when they're not set. They're not super good in transition, which is how all these teams come back on them at the end of games. You know, they convincingly, like, beat on teams, and then all of a sudden, you know, teams come back and they score, like, five straight goals in the fourth quarter, like Bryant did.
Yeah.
You know, so that – and that's how they do it, though. They do it by beating them with transition and going at the goal like they have nothing to lose. I feel like if Denver does that, Maryland's cooked. But if Maryland does that to Denver, which is also a possibility, especially with Bernhardt in the mix, dodging from the midfield, with IDA hopefully playing – a better game than he has in the second half of the season, playing his best game, getting up and down the field, you know, and obviously Maryland's polls are doing great this year.
Yeah.
You know, they're killing it. They had a great game the other day, and they're not afraid to go to the cage. So I really feel like it comes down to the intangibles of scoring in transition, manufacturing transition, and getting ground balls. I don't think that 6-on-6 is going to decide this game. I really don't.
Okay. And kind of before we finish the podcast, you know, Terry Foy, our publisher, has made kind of a point that usually the team that is victorious on Memorial Day Monday is a team that peaks in the quarterfinals. And we saw that especially last year with North Carolina. But I feel like all of these results kind of show that each of these teams are peaking at this point in time. So it's like, who is the most peaking, I guess? And I honestly don't know who it is.
I mean, it's a good theory. I don't know if I ascribe to it. I certainly think Towson is peaking. If we're looking at talent to execution, like that level, that kind of control over themselves and what they can do and controlling what other teams do, I think Towson is actually the best team at that right now, which sounds crazy. But if you look at the personnel that Towson has and who they rely on and what a great team offense they play, I think the only other team that plays a better team, six guys involved in touching the ball, is Denver.
Okay.
I think Maryland and Ohio State rely on four guys. I don't think that they rely on six. I think Towson and Denver have six guys that can beat you. And I feel like that maybe it gives them an edge offensively, but I think defensively the other teams, you know, kind of can match that. I don't think that's a super great indicator of their success. That being said, I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know. I thought Maryland kind of peaked in the Big Ten game.
Okay.
I mean, obviously they took it to Albany, but this game, that game was over early. It doesn't. We didn't learn anything. This is the most like upsetting thing about this weekend is we didn't learn anything about these teams other than they can blow people out that aren't prepared.
Yeah, I'll agree to that.
And that's the hardest thing. That's the hardest thing about analyzing a blowout is like, how did this happen? And for all of these teams, it's, well, they took out a jug and poured a bunch of goals on the other team, and then it was over. You know, that's really like you're watching the game, and you're like, how did this happen? You know, it's a combination of winning faceoffs, scoring on possessions, canning early shots, and making big stops early, and getting and grinding the other team down to the point where their confidence is zero.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like that if that's peaking – then all these teams did that, and all these teams are peaking. So we're in for it. You have a note here. Probably a poorly attended Final Four. No reason to believe the games will be any good. Well, I'll tell you what, Dan Abern. You stop being such a downer. You are coming to my house. We have great weather. People, you'll see. People will be so happy that the weather is great. You won't even understand how happy everyone already is. You and me, we're going to prowl the parking lot. We're going to get some free food, play some tailgate games in between games. I'm telling you, my people will show. And if the show is bad, they shall boo. Because that's what Boston does. Also, LeBron is a baby and begs for every call like a lovesick schoolgirl, and I hate his face. Don't edit that out.
All right, everybody. That is pretty much our show. Like Kyle said, we will be in Foxborough. If you see us, say hey. We always love our fans. If you've been listening all the way back since we were talking about frickin' Rogue One back in December, we appreciate you, man. We appreciate you guys. But it definitely has been a learning curve for us, you know, throughout the year. I guess this is the penultimate or going to be one of the last few episodes of In the Crease. Kyle's already, you know, flirting with his side chick, Chris Rosenthal, on the MLL podcast, which I edit. But, you know, if you've been listening at all at any point during the season, we appreciate you. Of course, if you like the podcast, subscribe, tell a friend, or give feedback. And you can find me on Twitter at DanAbern2423. Kyle, take it away.
You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at TheKyleDevitt. And Dan, sorry, you're the side piece.
Ooh.
Is that weird?
No. All right, everybody. We'll see you in Foxborough. We'll see you next week.
Inside the Cross Podcast.